You are listening to
Is Sound a Language
on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
My sister and I, when we were little, we would go camping a lot, and we would go to these campsites, and there were lots of people around, but we would just talk in gibberish and pretend like we were talking a different language. And even though we didn't know what each other was saying, we were convinced that anyone who heard us speaking to each other mm-hmm. would know that we were not speaking English, and that we were, what, I don't know.
Can you demonstrate?
Different. I can't. I wouldn't even know how to do it.
Because of the universality of it, it's like really hard. Even when I'm speaking my own language, I'm so accustomed to using many English words that people would know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But
we're not forced to learn any other language to make it anywhere.
Right.
Yes. I mean, and that's actually frustrating. I have found it frustrating.
When I was in Taiwan over the break, whenever I would interact with somebody and they would start to speak to me in Chinese because I love Chinese, and I would respond in Chinese, but then they could tell that I was not Chinese.
Yeah.
And then they would start speaking to me in English, and then I would be speaking to them in Chinese and they would be speaking to me in English because we were both trying to be polite.
Mm.
But it is not the most effective way to communicate.
That is so interesting. I have a question for you. So when you went to China,
Taiwan,
and like in local markets, did they overcharge you when they could find out that you had an accent and like you were coming from the West? Because like that's totally a thing in Pakistan. I mean, they would overcharge.
I think I should pay a small tax. But I went, my partner is white, so I would tell him to walk a little further away from the market so that, you know, we wouldn't really get taken. Mm. But, you know, I'm a pretty good haggler. I learned it from my dad, so I know when to walk away.
This brings us back to the question of our entire class, which is sound a language?
Yeah.
With my question to Annie, that is what I was wondering, because like even the slightest accent.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we examine the criminal legal system, specifically in California, through the lens of L.A. D.A. George Gascon.
George Gascon is the first Latino to hold that office. Gascon shares his perspectives on public safety and current sentencing policies and wholesale reconsideration of the death penalty.
We then talk with death row inmate Bill Clark, who has been languishing in prison for 33 years under a threat of execution.
This is a rare and heartfelt interview, offering a glimpse into the life of a man who, even after 33 years on death row, maintains his innocence. We talk about the historic petition filed in California's Supreme Court, revealing evidence of race discrimination in capital punishment cases. A petition that could help Bill Clark walk free.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
In recent years, district attorneys around the country in Los Angeles, Philadelphia, San Francisco, and elsewhere have broken the law and order mold as they look for better ways to address public safety, crime, prosecution, and sentencing in America, including a wholesale reconsideration of the death penalty from the prosecutorial standpoint. To examine the criminal legal system in the United States, we've invited one of the leading 21st century prosecutors in America, George Gascon, the district attorney of Los Angeles County, to join us. An immigrant from Cuba, Gascon began his career in law enforcement at the LAPD, where he worked his way up the ranks from a patrol officer to assistant chief of police, overseeing operations for the more than 9,000 LAPD officers. Then in 2006, he was tapped to be chief of police in Mesa, Arizona, where he stood up to the hateful and anti-immigrant policies of then Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio. In 2009, then Mayor Gavin Newsom appointed Gascon to be San Francisco's chief of police. 2 years later, Newsom again turned to Gascon to fill a vacancy created when then District Attorney Kamala Harris was elected California Attorney General. Gascon was re-elected San Francisco District Attorney twice. He was the first Latino to hold that office and the nation's first police chief to become District Attorney. On December 7, 2020, he took office as the DA of LA County. He is a former board member of the Council of State Governments Justice Center, a graduate of the FBI's National Executive Institute, and a former member of Harvard University Kennedy School of Government's Executive Session on Policing and Public Safety. I've known DA George Gascon for many years and served as a policy advisor to him on the death penalty in his campaign to become LA DA. D.A. George Gascon, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. So, you know, Stephen, it really was a combination of things. As you indicated, my family immigrated from Cuba. I grew up in a very humble, you know, very poor neighborhood. And frankly, police and law enforcement were not things that we look up to. We didn't in Cuba, and we certainly didn't in the U.S. I dropped out of high school. I wound up in the U.S. Army, and in my own personal evolution, that's where, you know, I started to get back into getting my education. By the time I got out of the Army, I went to Cal State Long Beach, and it was during that period of time that I became a police officer. I spent a lifetime in the LAPD, and I was part of the system, and I became also aware of the problems in the system, you know, the impact of over-policing, over criminalization of some communities, and that's one of the reasons why we have been so focused on police accountability. We've filed now approximately 144 cases involving almost 160 police officers that have committed criminal conduct, you know, and it's important to underline, those are not like, you know, some, you know, misconduct. No, this is criminal conduct that were, quite frankly, under prior administrations were ignored. As a San Francisco District Attorney, I work really hard to improve office performance and advance public safety because very committed to public safety. That's what I've done in my adult life. And as a, you know, my vision for LA County is one of effective community safety that is ethical, that is racially equitable, that protects the community, that restores victims of crime, but also honors the rights of the accused, you know, dealing with over-incarceration and looking at, you know, so many parts of our system that, you know, I used to say they're broken, but often it's not necessarily broken, that we're designed to the harm that they have caused and looking for ways to get us into a different direction. And that's my commitment has been and continues to be the safety of our community, holding violent criminals accountable, but being thoughtful in the way that we address safety concerns in our community.
George Gascon, you mentioned the importance of public safety. What's your philosophy on that issue, and how do you respond to accusations that you're soft on crime?
Yeah, you know, Maria, it's very interesting because unfortunately, as you well know, we are in a moment in our history where people do not operate in facts, you know, and we hear a lot of these comments about the soft on crime. And yet, when you look at the work that I have done, including the work here in the district attorney's office, you will see that we have a very strong commitment to the safety of our community. You know, we continue to deal with violence and filing cases involving violence. at rates that are similar or greater than prior administrations. We work really hard to address the issues of victim safety. We address the needs of our community by bringing everybody to the table. You know, it's really unfortunate that, you know, we often hear crime is up, and the, you know, one thing that we can say to that is, you know, that fear is up and crime is down. You know, if you look at LA County data, you know, violent crime has been fluctuating since I came into office. It increased in year two and then it decreased in year three. And yet, you know, you hear this message of crime being up. You know, homicides have been notable decline since I've been in office. Robberies, aggravated assaults have held steady with no significant increases. Burglaries initially increased after the election, but have stabilized since then. Even larceny, car theft, and arson, the levels remain consistent, indicating that there has been no spike. And again, you know, when you look at the charging policies, you know, we have been consistent with prior administration filing at or higher rates than prior administrations, which demonstrates a firm stance on serious crime and commitment to prosecution.
George, in December of 2020, when you took office, you announced an ambitious set of goals for yourself and the Office of District Attorney. What were those goals and what have you been able to achieve?
I wanted to make sure that we created a series of policies that were going to be based on, you know, science and data, and that they would be well informed. And to that end, we created a series of working groups that help shape and develop the directives that I put out when I first got sworn in. And, you know, it had to do with death penalty, with juvenile justice, with police accountability, with sentencing enhancements, with violence in general, misdemeanor prosecutions. And so those policies were put in place, and we immediately went to work on them when I was sworn in. And they were, by the way, these were the promises. It was sort of, I call it my contract with the community. They were very clear. They were well stated. They were publicly available. And I think that we've moved forward at tremendous speed. If you look at, first of all, by, again, going back to the central theme of the safety of our community in dealing with violence, we see that in the almost 4 years now that I've been in office, we have seen crime mostly be reduced in general terms. We had a spike, but then, you know, they came down again. And this was all really a lot of a pandemic related. We have seen homicides come down to historic lows. We see violent crime down and mostly staying steady in other areas. At the same time, we have done many of the other things that we talked, which really shows that you can have safety and you can have thoughtful, balanced reform. We stopped prosecuting cases alleging that, you know, seeking the death penalty. We have now removed 33 people from death row at the same time that we have not looked for anybody else to be placed there. An area that this office, you know, according to the ACLU in 2019, indicated that the prior administration had put 22 people in death row. They were all people of color. We looked at the issue of juvenile justice in transferring, and we're following state law. We're committed to the state law, which is really based on the concept that young people are rehabilitatable and that we actually enhance public safety when we treat them as kids as opposed to treating them as adults. Police accountability, as I mentioned before, we have filed now nearly 150 cases involving police criminal conduct. And again, I want to underline criminal conduct. We support good policing. We work hand in hand with police when it comes to the safety of our community, but we also want to make sure that police and prosecutors are following the law. We looked at sentencing enhancements, and we recognized not only the discriminatory impact of sentencing enhancements, but we also realized there is absolutely no connection between sentencing enhancements and the safety of our community. And in fact, the contrary is true. They tend to increase recidivism, and they also are extremely expensive because the longer that people stay in prison unnecessarily, the more that it costs to keep people in there as opposed to using that money for education, public health, and other things. So we have reduced the use of enhancements, but, you know, maintaining the capacity to use them when it is appropriate. And rather than just having a blanket policy of alleging every enhancement possible, as it was the case under prior administration, we now have a group of executives in this office that when a prosecutor wants to seek a sentencing enhancement, they have to get they present their case. We get to hear from the defense as well sometimes, and then a decision as to whether to seek the enhancement or not is made. When it comes to misdemeanors, we have continued to prosecute misdemeanors involving violence, domestic violence, driving under the influence, criminal threats, assaults, at the same rates, very similar rates as the prior administration. But on the other hand, we're not incarcerating people simply for being homeless or for being mentally ill or for having small quantities of drugs when you have a combination of, drug dependence and mental health issues. And that is also making an impact. We're also not incarcerating people, even if it's short periods of time, for driving without a license. You know, many people are driving a suspended license, quite frankly, because they cannot pay the fines and fees, and their license gets suspended. And all you do when you prosecute these cases that can be handled as an infraction and an administrative process end up actually not only criminalizing the person, but often leads poor people to lose their employment, the common house, you know, have the impact entire family. So, again, if you look at the total picture where crime is, holding steady or actually lower than when I took office, at the same time that we have implemented all these reforms, it shows that we are doing a balanced work of reforming our community, and we're really addressing this as in a 21st century prosecutor way, as opposed to continuing to do business and repeating the failures of the past.
LA County District Attorney George Gascon, you've been accused of not caring about the victims of crime. How do you respond to that accusation?
Yeah, Maria, again, this is where misinformation, often becomes the narrative. Since I've been the district attorney, we have done a tremendous amount of work to improve the way we deliver services to our victims of crime, beginning with creating a position the first time that the DA's office has the head of the victim services, someone with mental health background, so that we're using best practices when supporting our victims. We've also bolstered our victim services to show empathy and support for the victims by utilizing trauma-informed care. I am currently fighting state cuts in funding for victim services. I've been very vocal about it. When you look at our Victim Services Bureau, we have increased the number of victim services representatives by an additional 30 representatives, unprecedented. Our director oversees over 61 victim services representatives and about 120 employees. For the first year, as of July, you know, our Bureau of Victim Services serve over 4,600 victims. We have assisted thousands more with securing financial support through state funding. We created the first ever Crimes Victim Advisory Board, which is composed of victims of crime that come from very diverse backgrounds. We have men and women that have lost loved ones, sons, daughters, husbands, wife. We have women that have been the victims of sexual assault. We have people that have been victims of serious hate crimes. And those are the people that have been shaping so much of the policy that we are creating and implementing when it comes to serving victims of crime. So when you look at the work that my administration has done in the almost 4 years since I've been in office, is unprecedented in terms of what this office has been doing for years, from increasing the number of victim services representatives to fighting to bring trauma-informed care, to having someone with mental health care experience running the unit, to creating a victim's advisory board. All this are things that really speak to, I believe, to a commitment, a solid commitment to enhance delivery of services for our victims of crimes.
George, your position on the death penalty has evolved over the years. Why have you come to believe that the death penalty is wrong and should be abolished?
Yeah, Steve, I'm glad that you asked that because you're absolutely correct. When I was a police officer, I felt that there were some crimes that were so heinous, you know, the level of harm that had been caused could only be repaired to whatever extent you can repair the loss of life by seeking the death penalty, kind of the eye for an eye philosophy. And, you know, as I matured professionally and became more and more informed about not only how the death penalty is implemented, but the impact of the death penalty in our communities, I came to the conclusion that the death penalty should be abolished. And let me give you some of the reasons why I think the death penalty is not only ineffective, but, you know, it's actually racist in its application in this country. And let's concentrate on L.A. County for a moment. In this office, for instance, the prior administration, during 8 years, they placed 22 men of color in death row, which shows clearly how racist the application of the death penalty has been in this country, and certainly in L.A. County. And then you look at the fact that you have cases like Maurice Hastings. Mr. Hastings is an African-American gentleman who was prosecuted, accused of rape and murder, and the office tried to get the death penalty in his case twice. Thankfully, the death penalty failed in this case, but he was sent to prison for life. And then, you know, years later, after, by the way, this office had refused to test the DNA from the victim twice, telling him that the DNA in this case had been destroyed. When I became the district attorney, we tested the DNA and we found out that Mr. Hastings was innocent. So he spent almost 40 years in prison for a crime that he did not commit, and this office was trying to get him executed. So the likelihood of having someone being executed, that later to be found that they're innocent, is something that I find completely unacceptable. So we have the problem of racism. We have the problem of wrongful convictions. We have the reality that has been established that the death penalty is not a deterrent to crime. People do not think about potentially being prosecuted for the death case when they're committing a crime. So there's no deterrent. Then you look at the cost, the economic impact of the death penalty. Prosecuting a death penalty case costs multiple times more than simply prosecuting someone and seeking either life without the possibility of parole or a life sentence. And then when you talk about housing, people that are on death row, the cost of housing is two or three times what the cost of housing is for other inmates. So it's broken in terms of fairness and equity because it's racist in its application. It has the likelihood or the potential to cause an innocent person to be executed, which is irreversible. It doesn't make us safer, and it's too expensive. So when you put all those things together, I personally came to the conclusion the death penalty has completely exhausted its utility in a modern society, and it should be abolished.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, your co-host here with Stephen Rohde, and we're interviewing L.A. County District Attorney George Gascon. D.A. George Gascon, you've pledged to review every death sentence from L.A. County and seek resentencing as appropriate. How many cases are under review, and in how many cases has there been a resentencing?
Yes, Maria. So we have resentenced, you know, as of today, 33 cases. And, you know, under the law, we have the capacity to review cases, especially when you have, you know, you have some irregularities about the case, or you may have now under the Racial Justice Act, for instance, you can review cases where you believe that race play a role in the prosecution. Under those rubrics, we have resentenced 33 people, and they're moved from death row into life without the possibility of parole, which is the only option for this population under the law. And then we have approximately 20 cases that are currently under review, and I suspect that there will be more cases as time goes by.
George, you're part of a growing number of modern DAs across the country. Do you see signs that you and the others are making progress? in this divided country we're living in as far as crime and prosecution and public safety are concerned, and in LA County, what do you believe still needs to be accomplished?
I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, there's a group of us, you know, we talk about 21st century prosecutors. And 21st century prosecutors is really about how to bring balance, reform, how to keep safety central to our work, but understand that safety does not have to compromise fairness, equity, and ethics. And there are many things that, you know, not only in L.A. County, but we have seen a movement nationally. But let's say, you know, L.A. County, you know, we have decreased the use of cash bail. And, you know, the courts have really now taken the lead on this area. But this is an area that during my campaign in 2020, I committed to the elimination of cash bail to the extent that we can. Now, the state constitution still guarantees cash bail in certain cases. But what we could, we wanted to get rid of cash bail. And by the way, the reason for that is because, you know, cash bail doesn't make us any safer. What cash bail has a tendency to do is to have poor people stay in jail longer than they should, even when they're not necessarily dangerous to our community. On the other hand, people that could be very dangerous, if they can afford, they will bail out and go on to commit other crimes. And we have many examples of this occurring. There's also a commitment to the expansion of restorative justice practices. And this is really where you're looking at accountability through a lens of rehabilitation and reconciliation. You want to make sure that we're addressing the harm caused to the victim and put the victim front and center, but we also want to make sure that we avoid creating victims in the future by addressing issues of rehabilitation. You know, the issues of racial disparities in sentencing and in prosecutions is something that we have addressed, and we have taken that head on here in LA, but this is also occurring as part of the 21st century prosecution movement. Enhanced community outreach, building trust within a community between law enforcement and communities. You know, in our case, we have increased community involvement by creating advisory boards. We have a victims advisory board. We have an African American advisory board. We have an LGBTQ, a Latina, AAPI. We now have an interfaith advisory board. This is work where you're bringing the community in ways that were not brought into the prosecution world before to address policy decisions and really providing a conduit for the community to have a voice in the way that this work is done. At the same time, you know, we are prioritizing the prosecution of serious crimes. You know, our filing of cases for violent crimes has been consistent with prior administrations, and in some cases, actually, we have greater filing rates in some of the crimes, like hate crimes. What we actually have, we lead the state. We have the highest level of filing of hate crimes of any other prosecutor's office in the state, and certainly the prior administrations here. Improving the clearance rate for serious crimes, which again leads to better outcomes for victims and communities. We have created a process where we have increased the automation of data so that we know and can address issues of crime clearances from police departments, how we react to those here. Dealing with youth crime and youth issues in a very different way, you know, not having the blanket policy that this office had about transferring kids into adult court for the crimes that are qualified, and instead being very discerning where, you know, there is a very, very limited path for transfers, and when that occurs, it's being reviewed by very senior people in this office at the request of prosecutors, but also the defense is given an opportunity to address the issues and looking at it through the lens of the law, to where, you know, the yardstick in order to transfer a young person from the juvenile system into adult ought to be one that establishes that the young person has no capacity of rehabilitating, which is a very high standard. We've also looked at, you know, increased development in mental health courts. And again, you see this work not only in our office, but, you know, very common in area that 21st century prosecutors around the country are focusing on. So when you look at this work and you actually look at the outcome of this work, you know, crime, not only locally, but nationally, crime continues to go down, especially in the areas where you have 21st century prosecutors, you see that the work is being done and it's being effective. And by the way, population-wise, progressive prosecutors or 21st century prosecutors today are serving the largest segment of the country's population. So even though we have, you know, approximately 17,000-18,000 prosecutors around the country, the reality is that when you look at the major jurisdictions that encompass the majority of the population in this country, they're now most of them, not all of them, most of them have 21st century prosecutors at the helm that were put there by the people. You know, they were elected into office, they're being reelected, which means that our community understands that this work is important to the collective safety of all of us and that we need to move into a different direction. You know, we don't build cars today the way that we did in the 20th century. Frankly, we don't build homes the same way. We certainly do not deliver healthcare in the way that we did 20, 40, 50 years ago. And we should not deliver public safety in the way that we did 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago.
D.A. George Gascon, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. And thank you very much for what you do every day for public safety and justice in L.A. County.
Thank you very much, Stephen and Maria. I appreciate the opportunity to converse with you and to address the audience, and look forward to perhaps having a repeat sometime in the future.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
How does it feel when it's quiet and calm? And will I be denied? How will it feel when it's time to move on? Mother says, kneel and pray. When it gets hard, I will roam those leaves. Life can be so.
We may be witnessing the dying days of the death penalty in the United States. 23 states have ended the use of capital punishment, while it remains on the books in 27 states, yet the number of executions is in decline. Americans at large and political leaders are beginning to understand what abolitionists have always known. The death penalty is a relic of the racist past in this country. Yet discrimination on the basis of race continues to plague the system. 55.8% of those executed are white, but 33.9% are black and 8.4% are Latino, Latina, which is a gruesome statistic out of all proportion to the national population. Currently, 42% of death row inmates are white, but a shameful 41% are black. Today on Law and Disorder, we're focusing on the state of California, where there are 650 inmates still on death row, the largest number in the Western Hemisphere. 13 men have been executed in California since 1978. The last execution was in 2006. Due to a combination of court rulings and a moratorium imposed by Governor Gavin Newsom in 2019, there have been no executions in California in the last 18 years. Five inmates have been officially found innocent, all of whom were people of color. They joined 200 exonerees across the country. Despite the moratorium in California, 17 people have been sentenced to death, 80% of whom are black or Latino. The California Supreme Court is currently deciding whether to take up a historic petition filed in April by a coalition of civil rights and justice organizations arguing that racial discrimination in the administration of the death penalty in California violates the equal protection guarantee of the state constitution. The petition cites more than a dozen studies showing race discrimination. One looked at more than 55,000 homicide cases in California between 1979 and 2018 and found that Black individuals were more than twice as likely to receive a death sentence as white individuals, while Hispanic individuals were 1.5 times more likely to receive the death sentence. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, who is actually charged with the responsibility of defending state laws, has agreed in his response to this petition that the evidence of racial discrimination in capital punishment is profoundly disturbing. So those are some of the facts which describe capital punishment in California and the nation. But today on Law and Disorder, in this segment, we wanted to go beyond the raw statistics and take a close look at the human cost of the death penalty by talking to someone who has been living under the threat of execution for 33 years. He is Bill Clark, and he's joining us by phone from prison in Vacaville, California, on a prison phone system, so you may hear some interruptions along the way. I've known Bill for 24 years. Despite his situation, he's a hopeful, resilient, and creative person. He was convicted of two murders in the early 1990s and has steadfastly maintained his innocence as he continues to challenge his convictions and death sentences. Bill, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Maria, for inviting me.
We're so eager to learn how you're coping with your incarceration, Bill, and in some very surprising and remarkable ways. But first, I'm sure listeners are curious about your two criminal cases. I know appeals are pending and the legal issues are extensive, but could you briefly explain why you've been in prison for 33 years and why your case represents a travesty of so-called American justice?
Okay. I was convicted of two murders, one at a computer store in Fountain Valley, California, in 1991. And the second murder I was convicted of was of a witness. While I was incarcerated, by the way, facing charges for the first murder, I was charged with the second murder of a witness. I was subsequently taken to trial, and I was convicted of both murders and sentenced to death in 1996. I came to death row in 1998, and I have been here ever since. To give you a few bullet points about both murders, there were numerous eyewitnesses to the computer store robbery, including a veteran police officer, that none of these witnesses has ever identified me or implicated me in the computer store robbery. There were mountains of physical evidence, fingerprints, DNA, etc., in both murders, yet none of this physical evidence connects me. The actual trigger man in the computer store robbery murder was apprehended the night of the crime. He was subsequently interviewed by police, and at no time has he said that he knew me or that I was involved with him in the computer store robbery. Police officers, civilian witnesses, including the DA investigator, committed numerous acts of perjury with the prosecution's knowledge, blessing, and assistance. Oh, I need to make a very important point right here. Although I was not at the computer store robbery murder, the prosecutor created or manufactured evidence to show that I was there. There was a vehicle that was seen leaving the crime scene, a BMW. I owned a BMW at the time, but this was a different model and color BMW than I had. But some kind of way, the prosecutor twisted the evidence to show that this was my car, this was my BMW. But he had hidden the evidence, and he didn't realize we had it. He had hidden the evidence that they had previously collected of this being another BMW. Continuing on, the trigger man and the murder of the witness was never apprehended. So they have no idea who killed the witness. But they do have evidence and information that the witness's child's father was responsible for her death, but they suppressed that evidence. We ultimately got it. My defense team ultimately obtained that evidence, but the prosecutor suppressed that evidence. And when we tried to present it in court, the judge, who was obviously on the prosecution side, said the evidence was irrelevant. And the evidence, I'll give you specifics of it. The evidence was child custody hearings where the family signed sworn affidavits that her baby's father had murdered her, and they had no idea that I was involved with it. And until the police came and said, hey, no, her baby's father did not murder her. Bill Clark was responsible for her death. So the police steered them to believe that I was involved, but they knew I wasn't, and they just followed the police's lead. Next, I have airtight alibis for both murders. Obviously, the witness murder, I was in custody when that happened, so I couldn't have been at the crime scene there. And the night of the computer store robbery, I was in Glendale, California, working on a demo tape to present to a record company with several of the guys who were involved in the singing group that I was trying to manage, in addition to the engineers and staff at the recording studio. Okay. In all of my police interviews, I've never made any incriminating statements. I've always maintained my innocence, and that has never changed until this day. Next, and this is really shocking. This is going to shock most people, and most people find this hard to believe. When the police were trying to create identification and witness testimony, they showed every witness a six-man photographic lineup where I was the only African-American. So in essence, they put me in a photo lineup, my picture, with five white guys, and asked...
This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
And the shocking thing about this, none of the witnesses at the crime scene, even though they saw I was the only African-American, and this includes the police officer who was there, none of these witnesses identified me as being involved in the crime or picked me out of the lineup. The only witnesses who identified me from the suggested photo lineup were the hand-picked witnesses of the prosecution.
Bill, you've spent 33 years in prison in California, including 26 years on death row at San Quentin. Then Governor Newsom closed that prison, and you were moved to another prison in Vacaville, California. I doubt anyone in our audience has ever had that experience. What's it like to be denied your liberty for almost half of your life?
That is an excellent question, Maria. Thank you for asking it. Well, first and foremost, it's incredibly demoralizing, stressful, dehumanizing, heartbreaking, frustrating, painful to be locked up half your life for a crime you did not commit. It's horrific. You can lose faith in humanity, you lose faith in the criminal justice system, and you just want to give up, you know. And in most cases, well, in some cases, a lot of guys do. That hasn't been the case with me, but you're stripped of your dignity, you're stripped of your self-respect and self-esteem. Most of your creature comforts are taken from you. There's the constant threat of violence from fellow inmates as well as guards. Oh, the normal everything, everyday things that you were doing as a free person, that's all been taken from you, that's gone. So you have to find a way to create a sense of normalcy, and that's really difficult when you spend most of your day locked in a prison cell. Obviously, I've been moved from San Quentin, but I'll tell you a little bit about San Quentin. San Quentin is so different than Vacaville. At San Quentin, as death row inmates, we were basically denied everything. We got to go to the yard four hours a day. After the pandemic occurred, that became every other day. So that was the only time we really had any kind of recreation or social interaction, which was really difficult. Everywhere we went at San Quentin, we went handcuffed behind our back. Other general population inmates had to turn and face the wall when we were escorted anywhere to, let's say, the hospital or an appointment of some kind, the law library or what have you. So that was real demoralizing and dehumanizing. You have a tendency to lose your sense of self when you're just sitting in a cage doing nothing for decades. You have to try to find means, again, coping mechanisms. Most guys, unfortunately, have a problem with this, but because I guess you could say because I had the strength and endurance and capabilities and intellectual skills, I was able to craft a way to maintain my dignity, my self-respect, my sense of humanity, my sense of humor. So, but I've managed. It has had a traumatic effect on all my friends and family, especially my now adult children who were...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
Who were much younger, obviously, when I came 33 years ago, but they're now adults and have families of their own, but it's still taken a toll on them. It's put a tremendous strain on my relationship with them. It's unfortunate, but I've had to cope with that, and it breaks my heart, and I'm sure their hearts are broken as well. My mom, my 92-year-old mom, has had to deal with 33 years of her younger son being incarcerated, and it's put a strain on her. I do what I can to remain strong, to remain determined, and to remain committed to regaining my freedom.
Bill, I've known you for 24 years. How have you coped with your incarceration at each stage of your life, and how have you done it to survive with such a hopeful, engaged, funny, and caring person that I've learned to know you as over the years?
Thank you for your kindness and your comments. Very appreciated. What a wonderful question. One of the main things that has helped me cope is the way I was raised, who I was raised by, and the fact that I have a family that is incredibly supportive, specifically my mom, Joyce, and my older brother, Jonathan, my younger brother, Jason, our younger brother, Eric, and my sister, Lori. Everybody in my life, these wonderful human beings have helped me maintain my sense of dignity, my sense of self-respect, my zest for life. They've helped me keep my spirits up. Then I have some wonderful friends who are, even though we don't share DNA, they're like family to me. And one of them I'm talking to right now, his name is Stephen Rohde. And Steve and another dear friend by the name of Alex Ketley. Well, I have created and maintained some amazing friendship with some of my fellow inmates. We've collaborated on writing projects, art projects, and more. And I spend time with them, talking to them on the recreation yard, which we get to go to daily here at Vacaville. But another thing that is very important to me is I have not internalized prison life and prison culture. So I've maintained my, I guess you could call it, my free person mindset. A lot of guys in prison, they embrace the culture, they embrace the lifestyle. I have not, and that way you avoid becoming institutionalized. And I'm surrounded by, unfortunately, a lot of guys who have become institutionalized because of their embracing of this predicament. their predicament. I have avoided that. I like to use this phrase all the time. Indeed, I'm in prison, but prison is not in me. And I sort of live by that mantra. I operate by that mantra. And in addition to that, my artistic endeavors have fueled my spirit. I've always embraced the creative process. I've made things all my life. I've created art, visual art, written art. For some reason, my spirit is nurtured by the entire process of being creative. I love every second of it. I love collaborating with friends and allies and family to create art. I just love every second of it.
Well, one thing particularly that interests me is your poetry. Can you please read us one of your poems?
Thank you. Thank you, Maria. Absolutely. I'd love to. This poem was inspired by I created some signed handprints that I didn't have any paint, so I made some coffee, and I dipped my hand in the coffee, and I made some handprints, and I shared those as gifts to people. So this poem is titled Handprints, and I'm going to read it to you right now. We leave handprints on the world around us, on the lives we touch, on the memories we create. They are the echoes of our presence, the whispers of our story. Handprints of struggle and perseverance, of dreams chased and hopes realized. Handprints of tears and triumph, of every moment that has made us who we are. In the handprints we leave behind, we find the map of our journey, the testament of our humanity. They are the reminders that we have lived, that we have loved, that we have mattered. And when our hands are still and our hearts are quiet, the handprints remain a heartfelt legacy of our time on this earth. In the end, it's not the handprints we leave on the world that define us, but the handprints the world leaves on us. The gentle touch of a summer breeze, the firm grip of a mountain peak, the soft whisper of a loved one's voice. These are the handprints that shape us, that mold us, and make us who we are. I hope you liked it.
Bill, you were a guest speaker at a course at Stanford with Alex Ketley, who you mentioned, a prominent choreographer. That has led to an extraordinary collaboration between the two of you. Tell us about that and what you're working on.
I met Alex as a result of an ad I posted on a pen pal website called writerprisoner.com. Alex responded, and we began a wonderfully inspiring and mutually gratifying friendship. And one day, after we had been corresponding through the mail for several months, he decided to come visit me. And amazingly, Alex lives incredibly close to San Quentin, so it was no more than a 15-minute drive for him to come visit me. Once he came to visit me, we started talking about my case, and we started talking about my innocence, proving my innocence, and we started talking about how we could work together to help me regain my freedom. So one day he came to visit me and he said, "What can I do to help you?" And I said, "Well, if there's some sort of way you and I can collaborate artistically, it would raise the profile of my case and create interest." And again, I always tell people, my case cannot handle the scrutiny of the media, the media microscope. If you put my case under the media microscope, it dissolves. So I said, if you and I can collaborate, do something that is amazing, that draws attention, it would be a huge benefit to creating the attention, the public attention and media attention that my case needs. So he came up with the idea. It was very brilliant, by the way. Alex came up with the idea for us to create a film together. And the first thing that we did together was a film titled Distal Imprint. Anyone wants to watch the film, I guess they could watch it on his website, alexketley.com, or his Facebook page, which is also Alex Ketley. I'm sharing some of the things about Life on Death Row. Alex had dancers perform to his choreography, his brilliant choreography, and interpret my words. So you guys get a chance, watch that film. And then from there, he decided I should be a guest in his class.
Bill, separate from your appeals, you're pursuing a new legal avenue in California law to win release. Please tell us about that process and where it stands in your case.
Certainly. First of all, I think it was back in 2019, before Jerry Brown left the governor's office, he passed a law dismantling the felony murder rule. And the law is called Senate Bill 1437. And in essence, that law says if a crime is committed, such as a robbery or burglary and whatnot, and more than one person is involved in that crime, but one of the persons involved in that crime happens to kill somebody, only the person who did the actual killing can be convicted of murder. So, in essence, the other people, let's say, I'll give you an example. Let's say somebody, two people go rob a donut shop. One person is the getaway driver, he's waiting in the car, and one person goes into the donut shop to rob it. And the person that goes into the donut shop shoots and kills one of the employees in the donut shop. Well, the guy who's sitting out in the car cannot be convicted of murder unless it was part of a plan, a conspiracy of some sort, to kill the donut shop employee. So once that law was passed, hundreds of people have been released from prison. And my case, believe it or not, is the groundbreaking case for the law, because obviously, as I said at the beginning of the interview, I did not kill anybody, and I was not present at either crime scene. So my attorneys have filed a petition recently, and recently as December of last year, they filed a petition for resentencing. You know, once that petition is heard by the court, by a judge, a hearing will ensue. Evidence will be presented to determine if I actually killed anyone. And if a prosecutor cannot prove that I actually killed anyone or intentionally orchestrated the killing of anyone, I will be resentenced and released. It's not a declaration of my innocence. I'll be sentenced and released. I'll still be convicted of the robbery of the computer store, but I will be a free man. So it's a law that has helped a lot of people, and it's an amazing law. I'm proud of Jerry Brown. I'm proud of ex-Governor Brown. Let's say it goes in my favor and I do get released, then I'll fight to eliminate and exonerate myself of the actual robbery because I wasn't involved in any of it, as I said earlier.
Bill, we hope and pray for that day. Anyone who has studied your case knows that you deserve to prove your innocence, and you certainly deserve to be released. We want to thank you for joining Law and Disorder today, and I personally want to thank you for your friendship over all these years.
Well, you are more than welcome. It has been an honor and a pleasure. I have sat here the whole time throughout the interview with a huge smile on my face and another one in my heart. I've been so blessed to have you as a friend for over two decades, and you know without a question I'm proud of everything that you do in your life. I'm proud of you when you were working as a practicing attorney. I'm proud of you as a retired individual, as a citizen. As you know, I love you and adore you, and you inspire me every day, and I have to call you Big Bro.
Thank you, Bill, and stay safe.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.